Mr. Gardner?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, in light of the broad request for relief contained in petitioner's reply brief and partially in response to Justice White's question, I think it's important to focus for a moment on a procedural aspect of this case that hasn't yet garnered much attention. Pursuant to several aspects of the Ninth Circuit's decision, which are not before the Court today, this case has been remanded and there will be a resentencing in the Idaho State Court. Thus, I think the narrow issue before this Court today, in light of the fact that the case has been remanded, is the propriety of the Ninth Circuit's decision that the Osborne formulation is unconstitutional. And of course, as we know from Walton and Lewis, that generally mandates a three- or four-step inquiry. Is there a valid limiting construction of an aggravating factor? Was it applied in the particular case? And if so, is there sufficient evidence to, in fact, support it?
You say, Mr. Gardner, that the question in this case is whether that the judicial gloss placed on the Idaho statute by the Idaho Supreme Court was constitutional as applied to this particular defendant?
Well, the Ninth Circuit, I think, reached two decisions, Your Honor. The first was that the Osborne formulation itself did not provide sufficient guidance.
In any case.
And the second was that accepting the Attorney General's characterization of the utter disregard factor or the cold-blooded limitation as without emotion, it was not, in fact, applied in this case.
So it had made two separate holdings.
I believe that's an accurate characterization of the appellate court's opinion.
Do we know that on remand the Idaho Supreme Court is going to rest the sentence on this factor? On the particular aggravating factor or circumstance in question here?
Well, Your Honor, because of the nature of the remand, it's actually going back for a full resentencing hearing because there was a failure to allow any evidence in mitigation. So it's not, in fact, going back to the Idaho Supreme Court. It's going back to the Idaho Trial Court.
Did we limit the grant in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Just
to the vagueness question.
Just to the first holding that you described.
I believe that's right. That is the narrow issue before us today. Is simply the question of whether the...
Not the second holding that you described.
I don't believe that is an issue in light of the remand.
So the particulars of this particular defendant, the evidence against this particular defendant, are not really before us?
Your submission...
Well, let him answer right, my yeah, question. Yeah.
Well, I think necessarily, Your Honor, in the context of this case, in defending the Ninth Circuit's decision on the vagueness issue, and perhaps my response to Your Honor's question was somewhat too quick, is that the Ninth Circuit decision can be defended on either ground. The decision on the vagueness issue, which is that the utter disregard factor, as formulated by Osborne, is vague, and its decision that if it's not vague, if it does mean without emotion, as the state has contended.
But if there is going to be a resentencing here in any event, at least the most important element that we could decide, I suppose, is whether or not the judicial gloss, et cetera, is or is not constitutional on its face.
I think that's absolutely right. Because there will be a remand for resentencing, that is the primary issue before the court. And I think...
That's the issue we limited our grant to.
Well, Your Honor is correct. The grant of cert was limited to question one presented in the petition. Question one, I have to say, incorporated a number of sub-issues. The first and the most important issue was, in fact, whether the Osborne formulation is constitutional. But with that came a number of subsidiary issues. Was it applied? Was there sufficient evidence? Or was it cured on appeal? And I suppose my point is that in light of the remand, those latter three issues, I think, are less important for this Court's consideration.
Are there any statutory aggravating factors other than utter disregard that could be the basis for imposing a death sentence here?
Certainly the trial court found a number of statutory aggravating circumstances true under the Idaho scheme, any one of which is enough. So the answer, I suppose, is yes on the facts of this case. Turning then to the question of whether the Osborne formulation adequately channels the sentencer's discretion. The parties below and the Ninth Circuit And in fact, the Eighth Circuit and Tenth Circuit in Newland versus Armentrout, Moore versus Clark, and the original Cartwright decision have all focused on the distinction between subjective and objective criteria. And while I think that's a useful distinction, I think in some ways, with respect to this factor, although it's accurate, it is a little too broad to accurately describe the precise problem with the utter disregard.
May I interrupt you just a second? Do you take the position that subjective factors can never be aggravating factors?
No, Your Honor, I don't.
Okay, so this is within the terminology that you're using. Utter disregard is a subjective factor, right?
Utter disregard is a subjective factor.
Okay.
And I think this is precisely where I'm headed, Your Honor, and that is it's not merely that utter disregard or that cold-blooded is subjective. It's that if you look at the record actually before this Court in this case, you will see that cold-blooded can mean three or four very different things. And that is the problem with you.
So, I mean, you're saying that they have given so many limiting definitions that there is no limiting definition. You're not saying, now at least, that there cannot be a valid limiting definition which is phrased in terms solely of subjective factors.
I think that's right. I think there are some subjective factors that, in fact, can properly limit the sentencer's discretion. The problem with cold-blooded as one of them is that it is an umbrella term which incorporates several very different concepts. In fact, I think some of the Court's questions earlier today indicate that very problem. Let me illustrate, if I can, with what I believe some of those different definitions are. In 1983, when this case was first argued to the Idaho Supreme Court, the Attorney General of Idaho defending the utter disregard factor in this case said that it applied to defendants who lacked the moral restraints against killing, lacked the moral precepts against killing. That was how it was defended in 1983. The case came into federal court and before this court, and it's now defined as a killing without emotion, without significant provocation. Now, there is a significant shift. Those are two very different definitions. In Florida, of course, as we know from the Attorney General's briefing and from all the briefing in the case, the coldness factor is defined as something that we call super premeditation, which is yet another way to describe coldness. And so we see in this case that I think, is the fundamental problem with using a term like cold-blooded, not merely that it is subjective, but that it is an umbrella term that can refer to many different concepts. And there's a real practical...
I suppose it's okay if it refers to several different concepts, so long as there are a limited number of concepts. Is there anything that says each limiting factor must be limited to one single thing? I mean, so long as it separates from the generality of murderer, the murderer in the particular case, what difference does it make if it embraces more than one single characteristic?
I agree with you, Your Honor. The problem, however, is that when none of them or even all of them haven't been identified, then there's a real practical side to the problem, which is when you come into court in Idaho and you have this umbrella-like definition which contains three or four different possibilities, the parties, the defendant and the prosecutor, and indeed the trial court, who is the sentencer in Idaho, doesn't know which of the definitions to use, if any, or all. And so the problem is that you may have one trial judge applying the super premeditation factor. The parties present their evidence, and the trial court either finds utter disregard or finds no utter disregard based on super premeditation. You may have a trial judge in the next courtroom that's applying without emotion. And so the problem isn't that any of these aren't valid or that all of them aren't valid, but we don't know which ones are being used in which courtrooms.
Well, but maybe you're not entitled to know that. If all of them are valid, which is one hypothesis you advance, then the fact that one judge may say, well, this is a case involving super premeditation, and then the judge in the next court says, well, this particular capital case involves cold-blooded, there's no fatal flaw about that, is there?
Well, let me back up a step and say the first point is that I wouldn't concede that the definitions I've just given you are all necessarily independently valid, but let's assume for a minute that they are. I think the problem is that it still leads to the type of arbitrary and capricious sentencing. You can have a case, and this Court has two cases before it right now. One is Arad versus Paradis, which came out of the Ninth Circuit on this, where the trial court, in fact, appears to have applied the super premeditation factor, finding that there was no emotion. You have this case, where the trial court says, I find utter disregard because there is emotion. It's something like a catch-22. The judge knows it when he sees it. The parties really have no knowledge of which theory the trial court is going to be relying on.
Well, you have to say then that one of those approaches is invalid as a limiting construction.
Well,
not that they're different from one another, because you could have two limiting constructions, both of which were different and both of which were valid, I think, by hypothesis.
I think that's right. And if the Idaho Supreme Court were to pick either one of these, or in fact even to say that all three of these were to articulate a limiting definition that said all three of these, any one of which may be found, that might be sufficient. I use these three examples as illustrative of the problem. They are not necessarily all-inclusive of all the possibilities of cold-blooded. They are simply those possibilities that are apparent on the record. Well, one I didn't mention was the Webster's definition that's been provided to us by the Attorney General, which, contrary to Judge Trott's view that cold-blooded meant without any emotion, Webster says without warm emotion. I mean, there are as many definitions probably as there are dictionaries.
But that is a failing you can find with almost any definition. You can find different meanings in the dictionary for words. You're never going to get away from that.
Well, necessarily, we communicate in words, and there is an inherent imprecision in all words, as Your Honor suggests. I guess the principle here is that when there are so many different definitions, and we don't know which one any trial court is using, and we have no notice, we have no statement that any or all of them are proper, then that leads to the type of arbitrary imposition of the death penalty.
Do you have any trouble with the Walton decision in upholding that aggravating circumstance?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I think it's entirely consistent with the notion I'm presenting of it's not merely that we have a subjective term. What we have is an umbrella term that has these varying definitions.
Well, the umbrella term in Walton was one of them was especially depraved. And I thought we held that was given a meaningful construction if the killer showed an indifference to the suffering of the victim.
Showing an indifference to the suffering of the victim, yes, Your Honor.
So that would you accept that?
Oh, I think so. And
or evidences a sense of pleasure.
Evidence is, as I recall, the limitation, it was relishing the murder, evidencing a sense of
pleasure.
Debasement or perversion. And I think the reason that the cases are distinguishable gets back to really the practical side of the problem, which is when you go into court in Arizona and the parties are looking at the Arizona limiting definition, the parties are going to see, okay, what I have to prove, what I have to defend against, or the trial judge will say what he or she has to find, is not simply depraved, which I think is analogous to cold-blooded, but I have to find relishing the murder, evidencing debasement or perversion. I have to find that there was an indifference, shown indifference to the murder. The parties, if I can use somewhat of a loose expression, they know what they're about. In Idaho, the parties have to come in and they have to say, okay, I have to show he's cold-blooded or not cold-blooded. That's an abstraction. It means other things. What you're proving will depend on what those other things mean, and it can mean so many other things. That's the difference between Walton on the one hand and Osborne on the other, the difference between an abstraction, which is Osborne, cold-blooded, and something that is, I think, quite real. Turn for a moment to the factual findings that were made in this case. There were several questions on it earlier. As Your Honor has, I think Justice Souter, you noted some of the factual findings. Defendant did not instigate the fight. It was a factual finding. The victim engaged in an unprovoked attack. The defendant was justified in defending himself. And significantly, once commenced, the killing appears to be intentional. Those were the factual findings, of course, in addition to the fact that it was an excessive violent rage. I think if you look at those factual findings, I think you see that the Ninth Circuit was very correct in holding that if the cold-blooded means without emotion, it could not have been applied in this case. I think it's very difficult to look at the trial court's findings in this case and think that, in fact, the trial court was operating under some impression that it was without emotion was the touchstone
Did the Idaho Supreme Court have to accept the findings of the trial court, or could it reexamine the whole thing de novo?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we don't know that the Idaho Supreme Court was accepting. I find it impossible to see how you could accept both the finding that the defendant used it as an intentional excuse to assassinate and the finding that he was in an excessive violent rage.
Well, the Idaho Supreme
Court... I think that those two are quite incompatible to me, so I assume that the Idaho Supreme Court selected one or the other. It was free to select one or the other.
The Idaho Supreme Court could make a de novo review. I think if you look at the Idaho Supreme Court opinion, you find a similar tension, because they find in the same sentence both the aggravating circumstances and the mitigating circumstances are supported by the evidence. And that's really the only statement that the Idaho Supreme Court makes as to these findings that Your Honor has suggested are inconsistent. The only additional insight we can gain from the Idaho Supreme Court's opinion is their observation that, in fact, the trial court did not find that this was committed by plan by Mr. Creech. So although they may have been free to, they did not. I think that much we can glean from the actual opinion.
All of this is getting us into the facts of the particular case rather than the question on which we granted cert, which was whether the aggravating factor in itself is a permissible one.
I think you're
right. Regardless of how it was applied here.
It does go beyond the actual language of the Osborne formulation and talks about the application to this case. Then if there are no other questions on the actual application of the utter disregard factor, I'd be prepared to submit it.
Does Lewis versus Jeffers prohibit us from looking at the way in which Idaho has applied the particular definition in order to understand the meaning of the definition?
I think solely looking at Lewis, my answer would be yes, Your Honor. Lewis, of course, suggested that once a limiting definition is proposed by the state, and if it's a valid limiting definition, you can't look at actually how it's applied. That simply falls under the third part, the Jackson versus Virginia, whether a rational fact finder could reach the result. I think, however, there's a tension between that aspect of Lewis and Socha versus Florida. In Socha versus Florida, this court recognized that in a judge sentencing state, if the limiting definition is not quite up to snuff, you can, in fact, look at applications. That was a case out of Florida where the limiting definition that this court had approved had not been, in fact, used by Florida, and this court looked at how it was applied.
When we're passing upon the limiting definition in the first instance, is it then appropriate to see the manner in which the courts of the state have applied the definition over a number of cases?
I think under Socha versus Florida it is, and certainly in a judge sentencing case it should be. Trial courts are presumed to be aware not only of the articulated principles that come down in cases, but I assume of the applications in those very cases. So I think it makes sense that in a judge sentencing case, as Idaho is, that the cases applying the limiting definition should be considered. Well, I think, Your Honor,
if you looked at a series of these cases, you think you could construct out of the way this factor was applied some limiting construction that would be satisfactory?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think there's two.
Well, then, why
questions.
Are the application facts relevant?
Well, I think that you cannot construct one in this case because, in fact, the limiting definition is not constitutionally proper. I think were it constitutionally proper, perhaps you could construct, as in Socher, the court was able to construct a reasonable interpretation. The more theoretical reason why I think it's proper in a judge sentencing case or a judge sentencing state to look at the applications is because the trial courts are presumed to be aware of those applications. So it has at least to me some intrinsic sense to look at those applications to see what a trial judge sitting in the day-to-day rigors of his practice or of judging is going to be aware of.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner.